two films, one theme. This is Words in Movies.
Thank you so much, and welcome to yet another episode of Words in Movies. Hi, I'm your co-host, Claude Call.
And I'm your other co-host, Sean Gallagher. And today, we're going to talk about remakes, actually, for the next two episodes we are. Now, as any true blue movie fan would be, Claude and I are both getting more than a little sick and tired of all the reboots, remakes, reimaginings, and whatnot that have been going on in the movie business for a while. And we are among the chorus who say, why can't they just find original material and make that well? Having said that, I must admit that just as when we did our series on English language remakes of foreign films, that some of those were actually pretty decent, that there have been some remakes that are actually better than the original movie. Now, I want to make it clear we are talking about originals that are truly original, not more than one adaptation of the same source material. Like, for example, when we talked about the many adaptations of Little Women that are out there. But these are all remakes of original movies that I thought were better than the original. And with part one, we're going to be talking about, from 1956, The Man Who Knew Too Much, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, and from 1988, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, directed by Frank Oz. Both of these movies take place abroad. Man Who Knew Too Much starts out in what was then known as French Morocco, now just Morocco, before moving on to England, while Dirty Rotten Scoundrels takes place in the French Riviera. And both of these remakes have aspects to them that are unique compared to not only each other, but also the remakes that we'll be talking about in the next episode. And we will get to that when we talk about each of these movies individually. But for now, Claude is going to give us the plot description for The Man Who Knew Too Much.
I sure am. The film opens on an orchestra playing the film's theme under the opening titles. And as it starts to wind down, the camera starts to tighten in on one of the percussionists, specifically a man with a pair of large cymbals as he prepares to strike them together. And when he finally does so, we get a title reading, A Single Crash of Cymbals and How It Rocked the Lives of an American Family. So, we cut to that American family sitting in the back of a bus in North Africa. That family would be physician Ben McKenna, played by James Stewart, his wife Jo, who was played by Doris Day, and their 11-year-old son Hank, who is played by Christopher Olsen. They are in, as Sean mentioned, French Morocco when the bus lurches and Hank accidentally, he loses his balance, and he accidentally pulls the veil off of a Muslim woman. Now, this could literally become an international incident, but a Frenchman named Louis Bernard, played by Daniel Guélin, steps in on the McKenna's behalf. Now, while Ben is happy to tell Louis about all his family and their planned excursions in Marrakesh, Joe seems a little bit suspicious of all his questions. That night, Louis meets the McKennas in their hotel room for dinner, but he suddenly cancels their supper plans when a mysterious man appears at the door looking for someone. We later learn that his name is Rian. He's played by Reggie Nelder, and he's a hired assassin. Later, in an Arab restaurant, Ben and Joe meet a British couple, the Draytons, played by Bernard Miles and Brenda DiBanzi. They claim to be fans of Joe because she was a well-known singer prior to her marriage to Ben. The next morning, the McKennas and the Draytons meet up at the local marketplace. The generally light atmosphere is broken when a man being chased by the police collapses in Ben's arms, having been fatally stabbed in the back. The man is Louis Bernard. He's disguised as an Arab. Just before he dies, he tells Ben that there is a plot to assassinate an unnamed statesman in London. With his final breath, Louis tells Ben to get to London to contact the authorities to tell them to try Ambrose Chapel. While the McKennas are taken to the police station for questioning, Mrs. Drayton offers to sit with Hank back at the hotel. A police detective reveals that Louis Bernard was a spy working for the French government. Just then, Ben receives a telephone call from a mysterious man who informs him that Hank has been kidnapped and threatens to harm him unless the McKennas say nothing to the police about Bernard's last words. When they get back to the hotel, Ben learns that Mrs. Drayton never arrived back with Hank and that her husband, Mr. Drayton, checked out a half hour earlier. It's only after giving Joe a sedative that Ben informs her that Louis Bernard was really looking for the Draytons and that their only son has been abducted. Naturally, she freaks out, but the sedative has its effect and she drops off to sleep. Aware that the Draytons left Marrakech on a private plane, Ben and Joe decide to go to London and search for Hank there. When they arrive at the airport, they're greeted by a throng of Joe's fans, also the police. The McKennas are interviewed by Inspector Buchanan, played by Ralph Truman. He's from Scotland Yard, and he tells them he is well aware of the reason why their son was kidnapped. Despite Joe's pleas, Ben refuses to tell the inspector what Louis said to him, claiming that the French secret agent spoke to him in French. Joe then receives a phone call from Mrs. Drayton, who allows the McKennas to briefly talk to Hank. Checking into a London hotel, the McKennas attempt to call Ambrose Chapel, the name Louis told Ben, but they are interrupted by the arrival of Joe's old acquaintances, Val and Helen Parnell, that are played by Alan Mowbray and Alex Talton, Jan Peterson and Cindy Fontaine, who are played respectively by Hilary Brooke and Carolyn Jones. While Joe stays behind with her friends, Ben sneaks out through the hotel service entrance to meet Chapel. When he gets to the address, Ben learns that it's a taxidermy shop. And while speaking with the Chapels, it takes him a minute to realize that neither Ambrose Sr. nor Ambrose Jr. is involved in his son's kidnapping, and he's forced to make a quick escape before the police arrive. Meanwhile, back at the hotel, Joan realizes that Ambrose Chapel is a place, not a person, and she is soon met there by Ben. Inside this chapel, Hank is being held captive by the Draytons, who are the leaders of an international anarchist group. An assistant named Edna is assigned to watch over Hank. Also there is Rienne, who is being instructed by the Draytons to the exact moment during a concert at the Royal Albert Hall that he's going to be committing the assassination. It's at a climactic cymbal crash in the performance of a cantata called Storm Clouds. The McKennas enter the chapel just as the service, which is administered by Mr. Drayton, is about to begin. Mrs. Drayton spots the McKennas, but she can't get Mr. McKenna to understand what she's trying to signal to him. Ben slips Joe Buchanan's number, and when she leaves to call the police, Mr. Drayton sees her, and he cuts the service short. Shortly after everyone leaves, Ben calls out Hank's name. When he hears Hank respond, Ben rushes to Hank's aid, only to be knocked unconscious by one of Drayton's henchmen. By the time the police arrive at the chapel, the Draytons and Hank are already gone, and the church is locked. When the policemen refuse to stick around or otherwise help her, she heads off alone to Albert Hall to find Buchanan. When Rienne sees her there, the assassin reminds Joe that Hank's safety depends on her silence. Meanwhile, Ben comes too, and he escapes the locked chapel by climbing the church bell's rope, and he also makes his way to the concert. During the performance, Joe begins to put two and two together, and she realizes that Rienne is about to shoot a visiting foreign prime minister. Ben arrives at the hall and finds Joe, who explains it to him in a conversation that we can't hear. Ben goes looking for Rienne, and at the climactic moment, Joe screams, startling Rienne and causing him to merely wound the dignitary in the arm. Ben then jumps Rienne, and in his attempt to escape, the assassin falls from the balcony to his death. At the embassy, where the Draytons are hiding out, they are informed by the ambassador who hired them for the assassination job, that's played by Mogens Wieff, that their assassination attempt on the prime minister has failed. The ambassador then orders her husband to kill Hank. Mrs. Drayton balks, but Mr. Drayton agrees. With the police unable to go into the assembly, into the embassy, due to diplomatic immunity, the McKennas enter alone as the invited guests of a grateful prime minister. Joe is asked to perform for the guests, and her singing voice is soon recognized by Hank, who is locked up with a nervous Mrs. Drayton. Mrs. Drayton has a moment of inspiration and instructs the boy to whistle along with her singing, which guides Ben to the room in which his son is being held. Mr. Drayton then appears, but rather than killing them, he decides to use Ben and Hank as human shields during his escape from the embassy. As they make their way down the grand staircase, Ben pushes Drayton and the spy is killed when his gun goes off as he rolls down the stairs. In the final scene, the reunited McKenna family head back to their hotel room where Joe's friends have been waiting the entire time.
And Dr. McKenna makes a great joke at the end where it says, sorry to keep you waiting, but we had to pick up Hank.
Yeah.
So this is a remake of a 1934 film, The Man Who Knew Too Much, which was directed by Alfred Hitchcock.
Hey.
So this is the only remake of the four that we're discussing that was remade by the director of the original. It's also the only remake that we're discussing where the original was in black and white and less than 90 minutes long. Also, it is the only remake that we're discussing that where both the original and the remake were made during the production code era.
Hmm.
All of the remakes that we're discussing, the originals took place, other remakes that we're discussing, the originals took place or were made in the production code era, but the remakes were made long after that had expired. So the original version of this movie, instead of starting out in Morocco, starts out in Switzerland, and the character names are different. Well, I take that back. The family's name is different. Instead of Ben, Joe, and Hank McKenna, it is Bob, Jill, and Betty Lawrence. Bob is played by Leslie Banks, who is mostly known for playing bad guys. Jill is played by an actress by the name of Edna Best, and Betty, the daughter, and that's another change from daughter in the original to a son in the remake, is played by Nova Pilbeam. Also, in this version, instead of being a singer like Joe, likely to take advantage of casting Doris Day in the part, Jill is a skeet shooter and is apparently quite a good one. And Louis Bernard, who is also involved in a ski jumping competition, is already friends with Bob and Jill. And when Louis Bernard gets killed, the way that Bob discovers the information is through a MacGuffin, some notes that Louis Bernard had hidden away in his hotel room inside the wall, actually, of his bathroom. But the skeleton of the plot still remains the same. You know, these are a group of assassins who in the original are led by Peter Lorre, who would also appear for Hitchcock in his movie Secret Agent. And they are trying to assassinate a prime minister. They are doing it, at the Royal Albert Hall. It is Jill's scream that throws, and it's Jill's scream that throws off the assassin and prevents the assassination from happening. Now, the original is by no means bad. Now, Peter Lorre is very good as the assassin, or the leader of the plotters, actually. The MacGuffin is well used, and there's some nice British humor that you can appreciate there. And this is the first sound movie that Hitchcock made where you could truly see him start to come into his own, although I don't think he really came into his own until his next movie, The 39 Steps. But having said that, I don't think that the characters of Bob and Jill are developed as well as Ben and Joe. So we don't care about their relationship in the same way that I believe we do in the original. And the final shootout that takes place at an embassy instead of what happens in the remake goes on for way too long. Now, when Hitchcock did his book-length interview with François Truffaut, Truffaut mentioned that he preferred the remake, and Hitchcock said that the original was the work of a talented amateur, whereas the remake was the work of a professional, and he preferred the original for that reason. And I didn't always agree with Truffaut's criticism and his movie criticism in general. In fact, I disagree with quite a lot of his findings. But on this one, I'm going to have to fall on Truffaut's side and say the 1956 version is better. How about you, Claude? Did you see both versions? And if so, which one do you prefer?
I did, although it's been a while since I saw the 1934 version because I didn't want to mix up the two during this conversation. So I didn't watch it specifically for this. So it's been a little bit of a while. I find it kind of amusing that Hitchcock called it the work of a talented amateur, considering that the director was Alfred Hitchcock. So that struck me as kind of a funny thing for him to say. I did read that book a long, long time ago, and I kind of remember that comment and that conversation. I do like the fact that they did develop the family relationship a little bit more. I'm not necessarily thrilled with. I'm going to like just come right out and say the acting job that Christopher Olsen did as Hank. I don't know if he was just badly scripted or if he wasn't an especially good actor or what, but I don't know. He just came off a little bit like reciting rather than actually doing his lines. But, you know, for the most part, I still bought the relationship that they had with each other, like, you know, mother, son, father, son, mother, father kind of thing. And we also get, you know, a couple of extra incidental moments, like, for instance, before stuff starts happening at the marketplace, where you have that conversation with Joe and Ben just walking through the marketplace, and she starts talking about having another child, you know, which isn't necessarily, it's not quite necessary to the story, but it's a nice moment between the two of them. And just the way that they kind of bat the conversation back and forth is just kind of a nice little bit of character and relationship development for our benefit as viewers.
As well as the conversation where he's talking about how all of his patients in some way have paid for this trip and other trips. Now, as far as Hank goes...
Right, but that was Joe who came up with it first. Like, she originally said, oh, you know what? This was paid for, I forget what it was, like a tonsillectomy or something.
Yes.
And
I
never really thought of it that way. And that's when they start like saying, and this was paid for by this, and that was paid for by that. It was a cute little bit.
Yes. Now, I will say that I do agree with you that the child actress who's in the 1934 version is better than the child actor who's in the 1956 version. But then again, Hollywood child actors in general during the studio era were not that great. You know, for every Judy Garland or Elizabeth Taylor or Peggy Ann Garner or maybe even Jackie Cooper who knew how to act, there were hundreds who didn't or were badly directed or whatever. So the fact that Hank wasn't, you know, that actor wasn't great, it didn't really bother me as much. You know, I knew he was awkward, but, you know, that didn't affect.
It's kind of interesting. I don't like Hitchcock. He doesn't often cast children. You know, I mean, yes, you got lots of them in The Birds, but still, I mean, they're not really central to most of his stories the way Hank was here, you know.
No.
And sometimes I think, you know, maybe he's just not very good at it because we've also got that kid. What movie was it with the kid who covers his ears before the gun goes off?
North by Northwest.
Yeah. And I just have to wonder if they just don't necessarily give a lot of weight to the child actors because stuff like that happens or you don't get especially good actors. Although I thought most of the kids in The Birds, I was buying them. So who knows?
Well, you mean in the Morocco scenes?
No, in The Birds. I'm saying like the children,
oh, the children
in The Birds.
I misheard what you said.
Like, there wasn't a whole lot of bad acting going on there.
Veronica Cartwright is a talented actress.
To be sure.
So no surprise there. But I will say this for Hank, or at least the scene that I'm going to bring up that he was involved in.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the idea of a MacGuffin was around before Hitchcock coined the term. The idea of refrigerator logic was around before Hitchcock coined that term. For those of you who have never heard the term, it involves you watching usually a genre movie, this happens in, and you get caught up in it, you really like it, and then you get home, you open up the refrigerator, or at that time the icebox, to get a drink, and then you start to think, wait a minute, where is Richard Kimball getting all the money to be able to do all this stuff in The Fugitive, and how is it that he can be going down one staircase while Gerard is coming up another staircase on the other side of the door, and yet Gerard is able to see him and recognize him from that far away? You know, those are refrigerator logic questions.
And the answer is
yes. And my first experience with refrigerator logic was in this movie, the 1956 version of The Man Who Knew Too Much. And that is, if the bus doesn't swerve at the beginning of the movie and Hank doesn't accidentally grab the Muslim woman's veil, and if Louis Bernard does not step in on the McKenna's behalf, the entire plot goes right out the window, because Louis Bernard would have no reason to speak to the McKennas otherwise. The Draytons would have no reason to look suspiciously on the McKennas. There would be no reason for Louis Bernard to whisper in Dr. McKenna's ear when he's dying. And there would be no reason then for the Draytons to kidnap Hank or anything else that would happen. You know, the fact is that very few directors, and Hitchcock is one of them, could get away with hanging the entire plot of his movie on a monumental coincidence like that. So when I realized that after I watched this movie, you know, a lot of people downplay this movie in comparison to the other Hitchcock other movies that Hitchcock did with Jimmy Stewart, in the fact that they don't think that it's as psychologically complex as the other three movies. And my answer is maybe not, but plot logic-wise, it's definitely just as perverted.
Yeah, I mean, you could make the same argument about Star Wars. Like, nothing in that film would have happened if the two stormtroopers who saw the escape pod going away didn't say, well, nothing's in it, you know, because there were robots. It didn't have any life signs. And so all the whole rest of the movie got set into account. That said, I mean, coming back on, yeah, it's not as psychological as some of Hitchcock's other films, but you do have a couple of interesting moments. And I'm thinking specifically like when Ben goes to Ambrose Chapel, the taxidermist, and he's walking down the block and you hear footsteps coming behind him. And he stops, and the footsteps stop. And then he keeps going. He's looking around. He doesn't see anything. And then finally, this guy shows up and appears to be following him. So he stops to, let me look at my watch for 20 minutes. And the guy walks past him, and it turns out to be a whole lot of nothing. So that's a nice, tense little scene where, you know, Jimmy Stewart is like a little bit of a paranoid guy. And similarly, I think you've got a lot of tension going on near the very ending, right before Ben shoves the guy down the stairs. You know, again, you're like wondering, how is this going to shake out? And, you know, the people are constantly kind of rearranging themselves into different positions and yet not necessarily changing an awful lot until finally he manages to get the drop on him and give him the shove that sends him down the stairs. So lots and lots of at least tension there, if not necessarily like the psychological kind of, you know, peril that characters often find themselves in these films.
Well, I would also bring up the scene where Ben makes Joe take a sedative before he finally reveals to her what happened with Hank. Now, in many ways, this role is closer to the image that Stewart tried to project on screen in real life, and also would find himself playing in the 60s and 70s as his career started winding down. You know, as a competent professional who's a family man, but and certainly in comparison to the other movies he did with Hitchcock, you know, in Rope, he's playing someone who seems on the surface to be maybe nihilist is the wrong word, but someone who certainly thinks he's superior in a lot of ways until he realizes that two of his students may have taken that attitude too far. In Rear Window, he plays a voyeur, and in Vertigo, he's turned into a necrophiliac. Yeah. And McKenna is nowhere near as unbalanced as any of those other roles. You know, he seems like a normal guy, but, you know, when he's giving Joe the sedative, that is a little creepy. So that's some tension there. And then Hitchcock is also not afraid to use him as a figure of fun, like in the scene where the McKennas and the Draytons are in the restaurant and McKenna has to grab the meat by only a couple of his fingers, and he finds himself unable to do it. And because he's tall, as was Jimmy Stewart in real life, of course, he finds himself very uncomfortable when he's sitting down at the table. So all of that is a nice bit of humor.
Yeah, it's just like when he first sits down at that seat, he actually winds up shorter than Doris Day. He really drops down. And it's almost like his role as George Bailey when he first sits down in Mr. Potter's office and the chair turns out to be like very low because of, you know, Potter playing a little bit of like, you know, psychological warfare there.
Right. And it's one of those type of things that makes you understand why when someone once asked Hitchcock, you know, when are you going to make a comedy, he was genuinely perplexed, and he said, but all my movies are comedies.
Well, they have comic moments in them.
Darker than others, of course. But now let's talk about his co-star. Well, I am a huge fan of Jimmy Stewart's acting, not so much his politics, although it wasn't as bad as others. I like, with June Allison, when we talked about Little Women movies, I've never been a fan of Doris Day. Hmm. They're both of a type that I know were appealing to a lot of people during that time, as they were both very popular, especially Doris Day, it should be said. She was a movie star from the late 40s up through the early to mid 60s, maybe. And she was a popular singer before that. But that sort of quirky, wholesome type of image that she projected that just didn't really sit right with, doesn't really sit right with me. But I will admit, she is very good as Jo, and she even sings Hey Sarah, Sarah very well, a song that, by the way, she initially didn't think much of when she was asked to perform it. And of course, it ended up winning the Oscar for Best Song. And she performed it in a couple of her movies after that. And later it was used on every episode of her TV show.
Yeah, but I don't think that it was like she had a problem with the song in the film, you know, because it was, kind of a plot point. It was that she was resistant to like recording it for popular release. Right, where you have like a little bit more orchestra
and a children's song.
Right. But the thing is, you know, it's one thing to like have a song that you're gonna sing in the course of the film, you know, and it's okay that it's a children's song because in this particular case it's something that Hank's supposed to be familiar with, that he responds to later at the end of the film, no big deal. But when somebody says, hey, you ought to like recut that and put it on a record, that's a little bit different. And that, my understanding, is where her resistance came from. Not so much having to sing it for this particular film. Then it turns out to be a giant hit, and now she's stuck with it the way some musicians, like Bob Hope was never big on Thanks for the Memories, and I don't think Frank Sinatra was really that big on My Way. Same kind of thing.
He was not.
Yeah.
No. Now, another act, but she's very good when, you know, in that scene, when she learns about what's happened to Hank.
Yeah.
You know, and she's also very good when she's getting suspicious of Louis Bernard. Now, again, this is not something I found out until much later. The actor who plays Louis Bernard, Daniel Gellin, is an actual French actor, and he would later become known, at least for me anyway, as playing the father in Louis Malle's great movie, Murmur of the Heart. But just as with To Catch a Thief, which was also written by John Michael Hayes, this was the last movie Hitchcock he did with him. Hayes also wrote Rear Window and The Trouble with Harry. But in To Catch a Thief, Hitchcock cast another French actor, Charles Vanel, in a key role, except both Vanel in To Catch a Thief and Gellin in this movie, when they speak English, they were dubbed by other actors.
Mm.
And I did not learn that until much later. Supposedly, although there's no actual credit to it, Anton Walbrook, another French actor, but one who was much more comfortable in English, as you might have guessed if you ever saw The Red Shoes, where he plays one of the lead roles in that. Supposedly, he was the one who dubbed his Gellin's dialogue on.
Oh, okay.
But
let me ask you this. While we're on this particular actor, and if he's a French actor, we're probably butchering his name, and it's probably more like Gellin, but that's okay. We're going to stick with Gellin for now.
Yes.
This is a character who dies, you know, dressed as an Arab, and he's got paint on his face. Does this become like a kind of blackface argument?
I thought so when I saw the movie, but what actually happened is that they wanted to do that,
mm-hmm.
but they couldn't figure out how to get the makeup off, so to leave those white streaks there. So what actually happened is that they covered James Stewart's hands with white powder so that when they must have tanned him anyway and made him up, but when he's falling down and falling through Stewart's hands, those are streaks of white powder there. Now, Yes, it is a very uncomfortable moment otherwise, and we shouldn't pretend otherwise, but that is what actually happened. And I guess it's only partially redeemed by the fact that just as in Black Narcissus, when you have Gene Simmons made up as an Indian, Indian from India,
subcontinentally,
not Native American, that she at least doesn't speak while she's like that. You know, Bernard doesn't speak except when he's made up like that until he's dying. So, but it is, you know, I won't deny it is an uncomfortable moment to watch now, even though the portraits of the Arabs in the movie otherwise, for its time, are not bad at all, I should say. I mean, we do see Arabs in stereotypical roles, like the merchants where Louis Bernard dies anyway, and the waiter at the restaurant, but they aren't treated overly like villains or anything like that. And while the Moroccan police are certainly suspicious, those I think are French officers rather than Arab officers. And they would be right to be suspicious of the McKenna's story anyway.
Right, to be sure. I mean, most of the Arabs in this story were background actors, frankly.
Yeah. Now, I think that other good performances in this movie are by Bernard Miles and Brenda DeBanzi. You wouldn't necessarily think of Miles as maybe a villainous character, but you know, he's did a lot of movies with David Lean and a lot of theater work, but he's very effective as a sort of nondescript guy who nonetheless is going to carry out orders or else. You know, he doesn't do any mustache twirling at all. And then DeBanzi, who's mostly known or remembered, I think, for the movie that she did with Laurence Olivier, The Entertainer. And she's also in the original version of The Pink Panther, which was remade with one of the stars we'll be talking about in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, less effectively. But she's convincing as someone who believes in the plot but does not want to see any harm come to Hank at all.
Yeah, and that shows, like, you know, immediately she responds when they say, you know, well, you got to get rid of the kid. And the ambassador is, you know, kind of talking in code at that point. He's like, well, you know, get him out of here and make sure that nobody ever hears from him again, kind of language. And she's like, no. And, you know, her husband is like, yeah, we'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. And so you can see, like, right away, she's going to have this crisis of conscience, which kind of makes me wonder, this is like another fridge logic kind of thing. Why would you lock her up with Hank if you knew that she's kind of wavering on the fact that Hank's got to die? But, yep, there she is, and you can see her pacing, and she's very nervous, and then she gets the inspiration and tells her, hey, can you whistle along with this? Whistle as loud as you can. Go right ahead.
Well,
take care of that.
If you didn't lock her up, then she might go try and go downstairs and get a hold of Stuart and or warn the prime minister in some way.
Yeah, sure. Now that I think about it, they're both locked into the room, so she can't get out either.
Yeah. Now, of course, Carolyn Jones, even though she's only got a brief appearance in this movie,
she does her best Joan Blondell here.
Yes, but she appeared in a cult movie that came out that same year, a B-movie, the original version of the Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Mm-hmm. And playing the role that Veronica Cartwright would go on to play in the remake, the 1976 version. And of course, she later became known as Morticia Adams. But the biggest person, as far as, his acclaim in Hollywood goes, aside, of course, from Hitchcock, who makes his Hitchcock cameo in the scene where everyone's in the market, but the biggest, most acclaimed person to appear in this movie is the film's composer, Bernard Herrmann.
Yes.
That is him conducting the orchestra at the Royal Albert Hall. And this was the second of eight movies that he did with Hitchcock. The first one was Trouble with Harry. And he was originally going to write a different piece of, write his own music instead of the music that was used in the movie, which is the same music that was used in the 1934 version. But he decided that he liked that music enough and that it worked so well in the original that he decided to keep the music and not do a piece of his own. His only request was that he get to appear himself conducting the music, because he arranged and conducted his own scores. You know, he felt that anyone who wrote the music but didn't conduct the music as it was being performed for the score was really not doing their complete job as the film's composer.
And this might be the only time he actually appears on camera in a film, is it not?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the movie is notable for that as well. Now, one last thing I want to bring up before we wrap this up. Two things, actually. One is that although all of the outdoor scenes are shot on location, obviously in Morocco, but also the outdoor scenes outside the Royal Albert Hall and outside the church and outside the building where the people Ambrose Chapel work at, were all shot on location. The interiors of all those were shot on sets. Now, this was a standard practice for a lot of Hollywood movies at the time, and we've discussed a few movies where that's happened as well. Ronin and Kiss Me Deadly, to name a couple. But we should especially note that Hitchcock did not like shooting on location unless he absolutely had to, because he felt that he had no control, whereas everything that was filmed on sets, he had control of what was going to happen. And so it all was seamlessly done, so that the interiors of the Royal Albert Hall, for example, were replicated down to the tiniest detail to make them look convincing. And although I've never been to the Albert Hall, they look convincing to me. So it's all done pretty seamlessly. And the other thing that I wanted to bring up is that Hitchcock made this as a contractual obligation to Paramount. And later, he ended up suing Paramount, he and Jimmy Stewart, for televising the movie without his consent. And Stewart ended up pulling this out of circulation, which is why during the 80s, this was one of the movies he made with Paramount that ended up getting re-released in theaters when Hitchcock's daughter allowed them to be released. Rear Window was one. The Trouble with Harry was another. And I think To Catch a Thief and a couple other movies were involved in that. Now, do you have anything else that you want to add before we wrap this up, Claude?
Two things, and both of them are just kind of referring back to something where we got a little bit distracted. But one, as far as sets versus versus location shots, there are a couple of location-type shots which pretty clearly were done with a blue screen or a back rear projection type situation because, again, yeah, Hitchcock really liked to control the setting that he was in. And then second, just to come back... Oh, actually, I got three. Second, just to come back on... You mentioned briefly Hitchcock's cameo. It does take place during the marketplace scene. If you're a fan, it happens right before the murder. It's a very, very blink-and-you'll-miss-it kind of cameo. He does not make this one easy. So if you're an aficionado, you probably already know where it is, but that's around the place to look for it, right before the murder. And then third, just to come back on, we were talking about Doris Day's acting, and I just wanted to mention one more scene where I thought she did really, really well, was the scene in the Royal Albert Hall where she's just standing in the doorway and looking around, and she's looking at the Prime Minister, and she's looking at Rhiannon, and she's just looking around, and you can just see like about eight different emotions crossing her face around the same time as she's putting everything together. And this is like right before Jimmy Stewart comes in, and you know, as, like just the realization of what she finally figures out what's actually supposed to happen here. And I thought that was a pretty fantastic piece of work right there.
No, she is very good in that. And you mentioned in the synopsis that there was no dialogue in that whole sequence there, mm-hmm. other than, you know, when she meets the assassin and when she first sneaks in. And that's one of those scenes where we really don't need dialogue at all.
Right.
And Hitchcock does it so well. And I should say also about Day, while I was never a fan of her as an actress or singer, I did admire her very much for being an animal rights activist.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently this was the movie that turned her into one, because
yes.
she didn't like the way that the camels and the other animals were being treated in Morocco. So that started her work on animal rights.
Well, was it not Hitchcock who said all actors are cattle?
Yes, it was Hitchcock who did that. And when he did a movie with Carol Lombard, and she heard about that, she actually brought a bunch of cattle onto the set.
Nice.
Which was one of her many practical jokes that she pulled. But anyway... we mentioned once or twice about directors remaking their own movies and how that doesn't always seem to work out. Other than the director who remade his film Gloria Bell into the movie Gloria, the one with Julianne Moore, nothing to do with the John Cassavetes movie, by the way. This is the only other case that I've seen where a director remade his own movie, and not only did it turn out well, the Gloria remake of Gloria Bell also turned out well, but this is the only one of those where the remake turned out better than the original. Gloria is good, but it's about the same as Gloria Bell. So yeah, Man Who Knew Too Much, the remake, better than the original.
Okay then.
So now we're going to move, after this, we're going to move on to our next remake that I think is better than the original, which is Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
That's coming up immediately in your podcast feed, so stick around.